Our random evening has begun. We have some objectives to what you see happening here tonight, or what you will see happening. The one is, we want you all to have an enjoyable evening, but we want you to leave feeling that you were instructed in some way. To do that, we're going to try to benefit from children's literature. There's a lot of good to be gleaned from good children's literature. There's many lessons there if we stop and read from an adult perspective. In fact, one of the things you might try in your classroom is reading a children's story and then asking for maxims or statements of truth that apply overarching principles of life. And it's amazing how many nuggets can be gleaned from one short, familiar children's story. So tonight we're going to read a story, we're going to learn from it. We're going to use Laura Ingalls Wilder, On the Banks of Plum Creek, from that book. And there'll be one particular chapter that's going to be read here. We're going to read it tonight in what I think of as reader theater style. You can do this in your classroom, where each student is assigned a particular character. We only have three characters in this story. We have Laura, Mary, and Pa. Laura and Mary are going to be done, of course, by two young ladies who were old enough to face you and read. I suspect Laura and Mary may have been a little bit younger than our Laura and Mary. And then we're going to have a Paul, and Paul is actually going to be probably an age appropriate or age whatever, however you want to get that said. In other words, not a school student. And then we need a narrator. And you may need this too in many of your stories. It's not all dialogue, right? So our narrator this evening is going to be Gilbert Scrivseth from Bonner's Ferry, Idaho. Gilbert's a dad and a teacher. Our Paul this evening is going to be Verlin Miller from Red Bluff, California. Our Mary is going to be Mindy Bear from right locally here. And our Laura is going to be my daughter, Alana. While we have the readers doing their reading, we're also going to have some illustrators. The illustrators will use these boards. I told them to surprise me. I don't really know exactly what they're going to do, so other than illustrate this story. So there'll be plenty to hear. There'll be plenty to see for the next bit. That's stage one. Stage two, they will exit, and we'll bring the panelists up here. We have six this evening, and I'll introduce them when that time comes. All clear? All right, then let's roll. If the readers would please come forward and the illustrators go to work.
On the Banks of Plum Creek by Laura Ingalls Wilder. Chapter 8, Straw Stack. When Mr. Nelson's harvesting was done, Pa had paid for the new horse, Spot. He could do his own harvesting now. He sharpened the long, dangerous scythe that little girls must never touch, and he cut down the wheat in the small field beyond the stable. He bound it in bundles and stacked them. Then, every morning, he went to work on the level land across the creek. He cut the prairie grass and left it to dry in the sunshine. He raked it into piles with a wooden rake. He yoked Pete and Bright to the wagon, and he hauled the hay and made six big stacks of it over there. At night, he was always too tired now to play the fiddle. But he was glad, because when the hay was stacked, he could plow that stubble land, and that would be the wheat field. One morning, at daylight, three strange men came with a threshing machine. They threshed Pa's stack of wheat. Laura heard the harsh machinery noises while she drove Spot through the dewy grass. And when the sun rose, chaff flew golden in the wind. The threshing was done, and the men went away with the machine before breakfast. Pa said he wished Hansen had sown more wheat.
"But there's enough to make us some flour,"
he said.
"And the straw, with what hay I've cut, will feed the stock through the winter. Next year, we'll have a crop of wheat that will amount to something."
When Laura and Mary went up on the prairie to play that morning, the first thing they saw was a beautiful golden straw stack. It was tall and shining bright in the sunshine. It smelled sweeter than hay. Laura's feet slid in the sliding, slippery straw, but she could climb faster than straw slid. In a minute, she was high on top of that stack. She looked across the willow tops and away beyond the creek at the far land. She could see the whole great round prairie. She was high up in the sky, almost as high as birds. Her arms waved and her feet bounced in the springy straw. She was almost flying, way high up in the windy sky.
I'm flying,
she called to Mary. Mary climbed up to her.
Jump,
Laura said. They held hands and jumped, round and round, higher and higher. The wind blew, and their skirts flapped, and their sunbonnets swung at the ends of the sunbonnet strings around their necks.
Higher, higher,
Laura sang, jumping. Suddenly, the straw slid under her. Over the edge of the stack she went, sitting in straw, sliding faster and faster. Bump, she landed at the bottom. Plump. Mary landed on her. They rolled and laughed in the crackling straw. Then they climbed the stack and slid down it again. They had never had so much fun. They climbed up and slid, until there was hardly any stack left in the middle of loose heaps of straw. Then they were sober. Paul had made that straw stack, and now it was not at all as he had left it. Laura looked at Mary, and Mary looked at her. And they looked at what was left of that straw stack. Then Mary said she was going into the dugout, and Laura went quietly with her. They were very good, helping Ma and playing nicely with Carrie, until Paul came to dinner. When he came in, he looked straight at Laura, and Laura looked at the floor.
"You girls mustn't slide down the straw stack anymore,"
Pa said.
"I had to stop and pitch up all that loose straw."
"We won't, Pa,"
Laura said earnestly. And Mary said,
"No, Pa, we won't."
After dinner, Mary washed the dishes and Laura dried them. Then they put on their sunbonnets and went up the path to the prairie. The straw stack was golden bright in the sunshine.
"Laura, what are you doing?"
said Mary.
"I'm not doing anything,"
said Laura.
"I'm not even hardly touching it."
"You come right away from there or I'll tell Ma,"
said Mary.
"Pa didn't say I couldn't smell it,"
said Laura. She stood close to the golden stack and sniffed long, deep sniffs. The straw was warmed by the sun. It smelled better than wheat kernels taste when you chew them. Laura burrowed her face in it, shutting her eyes and smelling deeper and deeper.
"Mmm,"
she said. Mary came and smelled it and said,
"Mmm."
Laura looked up the glistening, prickly golden stack. She had never seen the sky so blue as it was above that gold. She could not stay on the ground. She had to be high up in that blue sky.
"Laura,"
Mary cried.
"Pa said we mustn't."
Laura was climbing.
"He did not either,"
she contradicted.
"He did not say we must not climb up it. He said we must not slide down it. I'm only climbing."
"You come right straight down from there,"
said Mary. Laura was on top of the stack. She looked down at Mary and said, like a very good little girl,
"I am not going to slide down. Pa said not to."
Nothing but the blue sky was higher than she was. The wind was blowing. The green prairie was wide and far. Laura spread her arms and jumped, and the straw bounded her high.
I'm flying, I'm flying,
she sang. Mary climbed up, and Mary began to fly too. They bounced until they could bounce no higher. Then they flopped flat on the sweet, warm straw. Bulges of straw rose up on both sides of Laura. She rolled onto a bulge, and it sank. But another rose up. She rolled onto that bulge. And then she was rolling faster and faster. She could not stop.
Laura!
Mary screamed.
Pa said.
But Laura was rolling. Over, over, over. Right down that straw stack she rolled and thumped in straw on the ground. She jumped up and climbed that straw stack again as fast as she could. She flopped and began to roll again.
Come on, Mary!
She shouted.
Pa didn't say we can't roll.
Mary stayed on top of the stack and argued.
I know Pa didn't say we can't roll, but, well then.
Laura rolled down again.
Come on,
she called up.
It's lots of fun. Well, but I...
said Mary. Then she came rolling down. It was great fun. It was more fun than sliding. They climbed and rolled and climbed and rolled, laughing harder all the time. More and more straw rolled down with them. They waded in it and rolled each other in it and climbed and rolled down again till there was hardly anything left to climb. Then they brushed every bit of straw off their dresses. They picked every bit out of their hair and they went quietly into the dugout. When Paul came from the hayfield that night, Mary was busily setting the table for supper. Laura was behind the door, busy with the box of paper dolls.
Laura,
Pa said, dreadfully,
come here.
Slowly, Laura went out from behind the door.
Come here,
said Pa.
Right here beside Mary.
He sat down, and he stood them before him, side by side. But it was Laura he looked at. He said, sternly,
you girls have been sliding down the straw stack again.
No, Pa,
said Laura.
Mary,
said Pa,
did you slide down the straw stack?
No, Pa,
Mary said.
Laura,
Pa's voice was terrible.
Tell me again, did you slide down the straw stack?
No, Pa,
Laura answered again. She looked straight into Pa's shocked eyes. She did not know why he looked like that.
Laura,
Pa said.
We did not slide down, Pa,
Laura explained.
But we did roll down it.
Pa got up quickly and went to the door and stood looking out. His back quivered. Laura and Mary did not know what to think. When Pa turned around, his face was stern, but his eyes were twinkling.
All right, Laura,
he said.
But now I want you girls to stay away from the straw stack. Pete and Bright and Spot will have nothing but hay and straw to eat this winter. They need every bite of it. You don't want them to be hungry, do you?
Oh, no, Pa,
they said.
Well, if that straw is to be fit to feed them, it must stay stacked. Do you understand?
Yes, Pa,
said Laura and Mary. That was the end of their playing on the straw stack.
All right, panelists, if you would assemble, please. Thank you. food sobers considerably. I have given a number of questions to help us evaluate this story. I do not expect this to be an exercise that your students will do. I was just saying the maxim thing is something your students will do, but we're going to go a little beyond that this evening. First, we have Kyle Lehman. Kyle comes to us from Romania. He's a teacher and a dad. And then it's Joe Byler from Fairland, Oklahoma, and he's a teacher and a dad. And then it's Jonathan Miller from Milton Freewater and his wife, Rose. They have a family, and John is also a teacher. Susan Hofer from Sterling, Alberta, and Charity Nolt from, well, she thinks like a Westerner. Has taught school at Milton Freewater and is now back in Pennsylvania. All right, so I'm not going to ask every one of you to speak into every single question. And if I ask you to respond, panelists, and you don't want to respond, you're welcome just to say, I pass, and hand the mic to someone else. So to begin, the first question is, would you evaluate Paul's responses in terms of wise, naive, well-seasoned, maybe a rookie, inexperienced, poor judgment, bad judgment, good judgment? And if you would, just tell us briefly how you arrived at that conclusion. Kyle, why don't you kick off there with the mic?
So, I don't know. I would cut it a little different than him. Probably wise, well-seasoned, good judgment. I think these are fair enough responses. And the way I would defend that is that it tells us in the text, at the end of the story, that was the end of their playing on the straw stack. So he reached his objective.
Okay. More Joe.
No, sure. I think that was great. I think somebody less seasoned or somebody not seasoned at all would have first disciplined and then questioned on the second offense. Would have come in and disciplined and said, now why did you do it? Somebody lightly seasoned might have questioned first and still plan to discipline regardless of the answer. But since he was well seasoned, he saw that contrary to how it appeared, they actually had obeyed. Right? They said they obeyed because they did not do what he said, and therefore he did not discipline.
Any word from the Miller team?
I would say well seasoned because he knew when to be serious and when to laugh.
Susan.
I think Paul was wise. He took time to listen to them. He didn't blow up at them. And when he understood what had happened, he got them on his side by explaining why it was so important that they left the straw stack alone.
I'm going to be a little more neutral on it. I base that on the fact that the girls were guilty the first time they came in. They didn't have a question about the first time having been an offense, and then for sure the second time they were guilty again. And so, but it's also hard to make a judgment on one story because we don't know what all led up to this. If they had a lot of other disobedience in the days prior, or if this was a little more of an uncommon thing. And so that's, yeah, it's a little hard to make a judgment.
Thank you. I'm going to draw a little diagram here. And Kyle, if you would hold the. There we go. If you've taken the CLE teacher training, this diagram comes from that. I'm always impressed with it every time we go across it. This is your typical Cartesian graph model here with an X and a Y axis. And unfortunately, the panelists need to see this somehow, but I'll turn it around and let you see, and for right now, we'll let the audience see. But there seem to be two defining characteristics of leadership or parenting, school teaching, if you please, that being discipline and love. And back in the 1970s, there was a poll taken among 4,000 teenagers who were asked to evaluate their parents and say whether they're high in love, low in love, high in discipline, low in discipline. And through that, we end up with four different types of parenting that emerge that I think you'll probably agree with. A parent who is high in love, but low in discipline, with me? All right. Such a parent is permissive. They can't tell their children no, which is perceived to be high in love, and they don't discipline them if they mess up. Low in love and low in discipline is neglectful. They're just out to lunch. Low in love, but high in discipline is authoritarian. But high in both love and discipline is authoritative. And this yet, to help us understand these better, there's a word to describe each one of those parents and how their relationship is characterized with their children. A permissive parent, let me think. Those of you, review time. That word.
Fear.
Thank you. He ends up fearing his children because they're running him. Neglectful parent flees his responsibility, and they do not have a meaningful relationship. The authoritarian fights, while the authoritative fellowships. Right, there's a lot of truth in that. And now we're going to ask the panelists to place Paul on this diagram. They did not have the luxury of meditating on it beforehand.
I believe you say primary characteristics and secondary. I'm going to risk putting a primary and permissive, and then...
Okay. At this point, you'll need to substantiate it. Just make a judgment call.
Same.
Excuse me, how did you define that?
Permissive? Be so low in discipline, high in love.
So he's saying upper left. That's what you're saying?
Correct.
Well, I would say that too based just on this story, but knowing all the stories, I would not agree.
Yeah, I was thinking of the whole set, and I would say authoritative.
Yes, I think Paul was authoritative too, just because I know the other stories. And his... He loved his girls, and they loved him.
Okay. I'll set this over here for you to think about in case it's not entertaining enough for your liking. Third question. At what point do you think the line is crossed for more direct punishment than Paul's response? Would firmer action have been defensible? Why or why not? And again, try to keep your responses sort of compacted if you could. Although if you're saying worthwhile things, we will definitely listen. All right, let's start with him. Joe, you're on the hook.
I would say to the question, yes, it would have been defensible if this was a pattern, an ongoing pattern.
And let's go the whole way to the end. Charity, oops. Do you have a thought?
I think it's okay the way he handled it just because of... the wording. But he could have punished them. I think it would have been defensible as well to punish them. One word of advice I got from another teacher is, when in doubt about an issue, wait to punish. If it's actually going to be a problem, it'll probably come back up again.
Susan, go ahead.
Yes, I think it would have been defensible for Pa to be firmer if he would have been able to do it calmly, and because they did disobey, and they knew it.
What about the Millers?
I have found that as I've gotten older, I just don't have as much energy to punish, so it's easier to go with, it's easier to be just a little more gracious, at least the first time. And I actually see that I see the wisdom in Paul in this. So I don't know how old he was. He may have been only 28 or 30 or something. I guess we don't really know, do we? But in his action, I do see a little bit of age and wisdom. I guess that would be my opinion.
And to Kyle.
I would come across firmer. I think he would have done better to be firmer. They were guilty the first time even. He didn't even have to tell them not to slide down. They knew they shouldn't have. So he could have maybe done them a favor by clearing their conscience a little bit with a hickory stick. And then especially the second time, I would have spanked my child. And I hope I still will. I'm just telling you.
Yeah. That's what we wanted.
If she's out there listening.
Okay, so we see what's happening here. Susan and Kyle are sort of emerging on the sort of the spank platform. All right, the next question deals with legalism, saying how do you keep legalism at bay in your classroom? So what this whole story is couched in is legalism, okay? Paul had said no sliding, and since he hadn't said no rolling, why, therefore they had the liberty... They had the liberty to roll, right? These things happen at school. We had a big mess in our school one time. Despite the rule that said no throwing balls except in the playroom, someone had thrown an orange. Well, you get the idea. Legalism said, I can throw the orange, even though there was a rule that you're not to throw balls. So what do you say to that? Why don't you start off with that, Bing or Rose, if you would.
They have to learn to think about the reason you made the rule. And I teach older students now, and so, you know, just to say, does that make any sense? Does that really make any sense to you? It generally works. Not always. We're all human. We all do it, so that's where I'm gracious, I guess. I would make a point, too. Kyle is a young dad. That's my point about
Joe, go ahead.
So to the question, how do I try to keep legalism at bay? I depend on a rapport with my students, frankly. I try for a good rapport with my students, and my goal is that they want what I want. And if they want what you want, they'll cross the line less frequently. And you have to exercise your legalism less frequently.
I think you keep legalism at bay by not playing their game. Like, when they roll instead of slide, they understand the consequences are the same. And I'm going to be a little more critical now of Paul, since I'm getting my courage. And this is, or just point out some other things. If you notice, he did not tell them why not to slide down the stack until the end. He said, these cows need to eat. Maybe he would have, or horse, whatever they were, maybe he would have been further ahead to say that right away. You're not sliding down. We need to save the stack. Instead, he just said, you're not to slide down. So he explained himself in the end, and then he got the results. Now my thoughts are getting a little foggy, but everyone's going to play this game. I'm not going to play it. If you want to do that, and the evidence was there in the fact that they're guilty. They knew it was wrong. There's 2 cents.
Well, it was definitely a reach across the table there to you, Bing. I hope you noticed that. He did agree with you that Paul didn't state the reason why. Susan, do you have any comment?
Yes, I do. I've learned to explain why in my classroom, why the rules are important. And this is why, and I've learned this too. To protect the students' right to learn and enjoy school and the teacher's right to teach. So that's why we have rules.
I like rules that cover a multitude of sins. So you can say keep your hands and feet to yourselves, because that covers hitting, pushing, pinching, kicking, tripping. And so that can cut down on legalism by having a little bit more of a general overarching rule. The younger the child, the more often you'll need to be specific maybe, but you can have kind of general rules.
All right. Well, thanks for that. I think that there's some good observations coming out here. Go ahead, Kyle.
Maybe his mistake was that he said no more sliding down the straw stack. Maybe Paul really made the mistake here, and so he shouldn't have been any harder than he was. But he should have said, the straw needs to stay stacked, or something like that, the first time. And then maybe he'd have been okay second time.
But I know what the old man response to that is. You're supposed to listen to what I meant. Yeah. All right, just a brief pause. At the end of this session, I'm going to ask Nolan Bechtel to collect some takeaways. And I'm feeling enough scattered that we'll let him do the wrap-up. And maybe he can get some takeaways for you to take home. So, Nolan, you heard that. Thanks. All right, the next one dives again into the classroom setting. Should a teacher have stated consequences for breaking the rules? For every rule, should there be a stated consequence? Joe, would you lead off with that one?
So I have a mixed answer for that one for my classroom. I do if the consequence could feel at all degrading or derogatory to the student. If it feels like a shameful process to go through, I want them to know ahead of time that, and by shameful I mean going out of the room while we check because you didn't have your work done, that is clearly stated so that it's not, I'm not getting myself in the situation of saying, oh, if you don't have your work done, out of the room, because I don't want them to feel shamed in any way going through their adolescent stages. On the other hand, if spur of the moment things come up, then I just try to come up with something that works spur of the moment or something that buys time, like just going and sitting in the office until I can come to you. So a mixed answer is what I would have.
That's fair enough. I like that. Susan.
Yes, this is another thing I've learned recently, and it's removed a lot of stress in my life as a teacher. To have stated consequences, we even go so far as to teach and model them what will happen if you break a rule.
Could you explain more the teach and model comment?
So I used, I had four classroom rules that covered pretty much everything. And then the first time they broke a rule was a warning, and the next time they went to timeout. So on the first morning of school, I showed them where timeout was. We had a student go to timeout. I showed them how to sit in timeout, how not, what not to do, and how I'm going to come around and let you know to ask you if you're ready to leave timeout, specifically like that. Showed them exactly what would happen.
Thanks for that. It's interesting, and I assume that you give it as with the recommendation to others. Okay. Charity.
I don't usually have stated consequences. Like Jill said, I mean, there are some, just normal things like not getting your work done. But usually I don't let them know because I don't always know. It depends on the person and the frequency of the offense. If it's, you know, a conscientious person that did this one time versus the tenth time, they can also weigh the punishment against the fun of breaking the rule if they know what the punishment is going to be. But you have to be careful. You can have your own list. Maybe I just don't let them know because you don't want to let your mood determine the punishment. If you have a bad day, it's a big deal. Or you just got a coffee, live, laugh, love.
Yeah, I resonate with that personally about that, putting the student in the cost-benefit analysis. Teacher says that if I do this, he'll do that. Is it worth it? Yeah, I think so. Right? I don't like that. Continue. Kyle, you have thoughts.
Yeah, I like what Charity was saying and also like what Joe said. Is that your name? Yeah. We have a kind of elaborate point system at our school that's been used off and on with mixed success over the years. Last year we had the most success with it ever, and it does several things for me. If a student talks back to me, it's 5 points off. And so when they talk back to me, I can just say 5 points off. And they know and I know. And I can go to them at the end of recess and say, did you make sure and take 5 points off? And then when they get down to 80 points, these points refresh every month. When they get down to 80 points, they help me clean up the streets of our village. We pick up garbage. And every garbage bag is worth 5 points back again to to earn them back above 80. But some value of, now, big downside is just another thing to try to enforce, and I am not a very good enforcer at all. But an upside is I'm not passionate. I'm not lashing out at them. When they break the rule, they know what the consequence is. I can state it to them clearly, and they understand I'm not mad. I'm not being irrational. I'm not happy or sad today. Another advantage of it, my mind's failing me.
We can come back.
Oh, another advantage of it is my personality. I hate disciplining people. Most people probably do. And not only that, it's hard for me. I'll sit in my bedroom and be like, okay, if Johnny talks back to me today, I'm going to make him stay in for 5 minutes at recess. But when you're actually in the classroom and he talks back to you, I'm like, God, let's just let it slide one more time. That's who I am as a teacher. And if I know this is 3 points off, and everyone knows it's 3 points off when he does it, it forces me to say 3 points off. I have to almost burn my bridges behind myself if I'm actually going to do hard things in life. And it's one way that I can burn the bridge behind me.
I am attracted to the efficiency of 5 points off and it communicated. There it is. Nice, tidy package.
Yeah, I like that. I've used different methods, similar to Kyle. I do also really like the idea, like it's been stated, of not, especially with teenagers, if you have teenagers who like to get attention by being naughty, imagine that. To actually be bad so they have to do the consequence, and kind of it's just another notch for them. If the consequence is known and it's not too bad, it's a nice, easy little notch. Just take that option away. And they don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes that can be good.
Anything else, Rose? One of the things that I've noticed in working with children, if you state the rule and the consequence when it's broken, students, children are masters of breaking that thing slightly off center. So you don't know, does the consequence still apply? And I'm left in a dither. Does the consequence apply? Does it apply in a modified way? If I stated it to them before, and now it didn't quite apply, well, am I being fair by not, by changing my consequence? And I get knotted up in those things. If you don't, that's great. So you have to know yourself. You heard that coming from Kyle, too. So what works best for you may not work best for the person down the table. And that's fine. I'll just weigh on this a little bit. I typically did not state the consequence except if it had to do with late work. I'm not exactly sure why. I really like the logic that Joe gave as to when to state a consequence, when it may be interpreted as demeaning to the student. That's really sensible to me. But I tried to tell the student in my first day of school paperwork, I had these two words about what will happen if rules are broken. It will be one, something, and it will be two, fair. And that's about all the further we went. So that way, if a student is in this cost-benefit analysis, he's left thinking, teacher said he will do something. But he also said it will be fair. But I also explain a little bit that it's fair according to my interpretation. All right, we're going to go to the last question of the evening. How do we determine whether or not we are being firm enough with school students? How do we determine whether or not we are being firm enough, and I could just say with our school students? There is a continuum. But how do we know whether we're in the green? Who'll start? Kyle.
First off, I think that on that whiteboard there, they say that the people who are stricter, their children turn out better. So I personally feel like it's better to err on the firm side than the soft side, because, and you've heard this all evening now, but because children generally thrive better if you err on that side than if you err on the other side. So I'd say it's difficult for me to be firm enough. But I think I would know when I crossed that firmness point, when I lost their goodwill or I lost their heart in it.
Mm-hmm. Let's just go down the row.
So my answer to this would be, how secure is your class? How secure do your students feel? And if your students feel secure and safe at school, then you're probably in the green, would be my thought on that. One thing related to that is when your class can go from seeming chaos to order, not immediately, but very quickly and easily and seamlessly, when you call order, then probably you're in the green.
Probably two things. If you have a happy classroom, happy, productive, people are happy to be there, that's great. So happy and productive. And when you as a teacher can say something that is out of the ordinary, I want you to do this, and you expect them to do it, there's not a lot of concern that they might not do it. That's a good sign.
Rose, feel free. Okay, go ahead.
One thing that's been huge for me is learning to have it firmly in my own mind what is allowed and what is not. I really can struggle with gray areas. Now, did they break a rule or didn't they? So that's why the four simple rules just made so much sense for me. And I can then drop all the scolding and lecturing and coaxing and, okay, well, this time it didn't matter. And then I think what I'm maybe still learning is then to just be consistently kind and pleasant to everybody all the time, because I know what I'm going to do if something happens.
I don't have a lot to add. I guess if your classroom is in constant disarray, you're probably not being firm enough. I think the longer I taught, the stricter I got, maybe. I also liked what Ivan said last night, that point about don't let your children do things that make you not like them, or however he said that. And so I think that's a guide as well.
All right. Does the audience have any questions for our panelists? I was not planning to do that, but I think we finished in enough time that if you're quick, we have a minute for that. Anything from the audience that you'd like to ask? Yes, sir. What are the four rules that cover everything?
Well, my classroom rules, number one was listen and follow all directions. Number two, raise your hand before speaking or leaving your seat. Number three was keep hands, feet, and objects to yourself. And the fourth one was to respect your teacher and classmates.
And you found that to be comprehensive, generally?
Generally. And then I really hit a spot where I realized it was because it wasn't clear in my mind. I struggled with gray areas, and I started micromanaging. Did they break a rule or didn't they? Because I was scared to just say, this does and this doesn't. In my own mind first.
Another question? All right, then, that concludes. We'll give the time to Nolan, and if you would.
So for some takeaways, give a mic. Yeah, all right, Derek, where art thou? There you are. Jonathan will give you a mic so that everyone can hear. And we've got several of us that will share a few takeaways from our varying perspectives.
I really want to give two. Can I give two?
Or three.
The first one is stay away from temptation. The second one is ask questions before disciplining.
All right. Thank you. Conrad.
I'm not sure how to make this concise, but for older students especially, teach them with the consequences of discipline that they need to think about how their actions affect others. Like Laura and Mary needed to be thinking about how the animals wouldn't have straw if they did this. For older students, not so much for younger ones that can't reason yet.
Thank you. Tedrick. Would you stand? There you are.
I'm going to just quote charity. Use rules that cover a multitude of sins. It teaches the spirit of the law, not only the letter of it. I've found that very successful.
Thank you. Nathan.
I appreciated the emphasis on explaining the why behind the rule, especially for older students. But I think the phrase that stood out to me that is just really helpful to keep in mind when thinking about disciplining was, when in doubt, wait to punish.
Thank you. Say what you mean and mean what you say. Be clear in direction. It must stay stacked. Say what you mean. Remember, you won't cover all the thinkable possibilities. Your students may outthink you. If students are allowed, if students are successful in avoiding incrimination by finding technical loopholes, especially as pertains to the authority in their life, there'll be no end to their questioning of authority. I also like the thought that came from wrapping this up. A secure environment will allow for a few chuckles in the midst of chaos, mercy to be shown, and the correction of mistakes. But if chaos is the norm, you don't stand a chance. You don't stand a chance with your back shaken as you turn and go out the room.